Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
In Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 2 through 7 is in Aramaic. It's the Aramaic section of the book, which says that 7 is the conclusion. Now, most folks divide the book into 1 through 6, being historical in Daniel's day, and 7 through 12, futuristic. But I really think chapter 7 is the culmination of the historical section of Daniel. And the reason I think that is, 7 and 8, chapters 7 and 8, are related to chapter 2. In chapter 2, there are four earthly kingdoms that is going to be superseded by a fifth spiritual eternal kingdom. Well, the very same outline is in chapter 7. In chapter 8, the second and third empires are defined in greater detail. We must see this overall scope. So the gold and silver and bronze and then iron and clay of chapter 2 is synonymous with the winged lion, the bear, the leopard, and the beast of chapter 7. Now, there's been a lot of confusion here, mostly because of eschatological biases. Many people come to this chapter knowing what it ought to say, and therefore they force this interpretation. Now, I want to say to you, one of the major problems in interpreting it is the little horn of chapter 7 is different from the little horn of chapter 8. The little horn of chapter 7 comes in the fourth kingdom. The little horn of chapter 8 comes in the third kingdom. Now, I believe the little horn of 7 is the Antichrist, and the little horn of 8 is Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes during the Maccabean period. Much of the difficulty of interpreting the book of Daniel has been because some people are nervous about predictive prophecy and say that Daniel was not written in the 6th century B.C., but during the Maccabean period, and they try to make these four different kingdoms in with the Grecian generals, Alexander's four generals. I really think the fourth kingdom is Rome, and as we get in this chapter, it'll make more sense. So let's begin Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now, we're somewhere around 553 to 551 B.C. Notice the book of Daniel is out of chronological sequence, because Belshazzar has lost the kingdom and his life back in chapter 5. And so the book is somehow out of sequence. Now, Daniel saw a dream, visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Same thing happened to Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2 is now happening to Daniel. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. So Daniel is giving not a detailed description, but a summary of the high points of this particular vision. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven. Now, four is the number of the earth. This seems to represent universal elements, possibly angelic. That's what Jerome says. Now, it's not so much that heaven is causing these nations to do this, but it seems like the world forces are in coagulation and confusion. And so he saw a sea with four winds blowing on at the same time. Notice we're stirring up forces beyond man and yet caused by the earthly fall. A great sea. Now, this great sea has been interpreted in several ways. Notice it's mentioned again as the sea in chapter 3. Larkin, from the Plymouth Brethren background, Darby and Larkin, which are basically the beginning of dispensational premillennialism, makes a distinction between this great sea in chapter 2, which he calls the Mediterranean, and the sea in chapter 3, which he calls mankind in general. Now, really, I think what we have here is four basic interpretations. Number one, the nations of the earth. You might well see Isaiah 17, 12, and 13, Isaiah 27, 1, Isaiah 57, 20, and Revelation 17, 15. That's a real possibility. Some say it's the Mediterranean Ocean, and they use it literally, going back to Numbers 34, 6, and 7, and Joshua 9, 1. Scofield and Larkin thought it was unorganized mass of humanity. They take it from Matthew 13:47 and Revelation 13:1. Those who are more in the line of apocalyptic interpretations think it's the cosmic ocean of the creation account, and they go to Genesis chapter 1 verse 2. They go to Psalms 36:6, to Isaiah 51:10, and to Amos 7:4. I think it's a vision. It's just tumultuous waters, and out of this are going to come four beasts that represent kings and kingdoms. Now, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea. parallel to chapter 2. Remember that. Different from one another. Now, are they coming up simultaneously? Or are they coming up one after another? Well, it seems they're going to be coming up one after another. They're in sequential order is what it seems. The first was like a lion that had wings of an eagle. Now, this we know is a symbol of Babylon that's been found on the gates and all of the Neo-Babylonian Empire of Nebuchadnezzar. You might want to see Jeremiah 49:22, Habakkuk 1:8, and Ezekiel 17:3 for a lion with eagle's wings to represent Babylon. And there's many pictures of the Sphinx kind of animal to do that. Now, the rest of verse 4 seems to describe something that happened to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, where an animal mind was given to him, and he ate grass for a period because of his arrogance. And so the rest of chapter 4 seems to describe that chapter 4 experience of Nebuchadnezzar II, the Neo-Babylonian ruler. Now, in verse 5, we have the bear. Now, one resembling a bear, it was raised up on one side. There have been several theories about this. Raised up as if walking, or raised up as if one part of the partnership was more important. Like, we think this is Medo-Persia, and Persia was more dominant than Media. And some think that's what it means here. Notice it had three ribs in his mouth. Now, some have said three, meaning describe its viciousness. Some say three is connected with chapter 8, verse 20, where it describes the directions that Medo-Persia conquered. And that would be Babylon to the west, Lydia to the north, and Egypt to the south. I don't think we can push these number symbolism too much here. Now, in verse 6, we have a leopard with four wings. The wing speaks of the speed. Now, because of that, we think it's Alexander the Great. It's going to have four heads, which seem to describe the four generals that took over after Alexander's early death. And so I think we have the Greek Empire here in verse 6 with the wings. And the four generals, the four heads, would be Ptolemy in Egypt, Philip in Macedon, Seleucus in Syria, and Lysimachus in Thrace. And those were the four generals. Antiochus Epiphanes will be out of the Seleucid Syrian Empire. Now, notice where it says in verse 7, a fourth beast. And this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. Now, E.J. Young, whose commentary on Daniel I like very much, says there's a progressive stage of fierceness. But I really think that won't hold water. I think it's a terrible beast. It's animal, but it's so bad that no animal really describes it. And so it's undescript, but it's bestial. A dreadful and terrible, and extremely strong, with large iron teeth. And that may be parallel to the iron that's mentioned in the fourth kingdom of chapter 2, which I think it is, and I think it's Rome. Now, I think it's the historical Rome and the Roman-type government that characterizes the earth today and will characterize the end-time government during the Antichrist time. Now, it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the other beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, the 10 horns, because three of them are going to be ripped out by the little horn, seem not to be sequential kings, but simultaneous kings. Now, because of the difficulty of that, I really believe we don't need to look for 10 literal kings, like the common market of Europe or something like that, or 10 Caesars or 10 Seleucid rulers. I think the number 10 speaks of completeness, and it means the complete number of kings, not sequential order here, because the three are going to be replaced by the one. Now, notice it mentions, while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Now, that seems to speak of the veracity and power of this little horn. Now, this little horn, I think, is in the fourth kingdom, obviously, in chapter 7. I think it's a type of the Antichrist. Now, in chapter 8, there's going to be a little horn, but it's going to be in the third kingdom, which would be Grecian, or the four generals following the Grecian period. I think it's Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. And there's been a lot of confusion over that. You've got to see the difference, okay? Now, let's see. Okay, then verse 9. Now, the scene is changing from this four beasts and their control of the earth. Now we're moving to heaven, another scene. And I kept looking until thrones were set up. Now, thrones, it seems to be a judgment scene, not a council of thrones like the heavenly council, but God on his throne and other seats set out in front. It's often been said, who were those thrones for? Well, some think for the angels, basing on Psalms 89, 7 and 8. Some think it's the saints of God, basing on Luke 22:30, 1 Corinthians 6:2, Revelation 20, verse 4, and verses 18, 22, and 27 of this chapter. possible. Others say minor judges that are unidentified. I don't know who all the seats were for, but obviously the throne room of heaven, much like Revelation chapter 4 and 5. Now, my translation says we're set up. King James has cast down. That is the basic etymology of this Aramaic word, but it means to arrange swiftly. And that's the idea. The Ancient of Days took his seat. There is no article here with the term Ancient of Days, as there is in verses 13 and 22, so we're emphasizing the characteristic of the longevity of the person, not necessarily the title, the Ancient of Days, which is in 13 and 22. His vesture was white as snow, his hair was like wool, his throne was a blaze of flame, his wheels were like burning fire. This is not a description of God, because God is spirit. But this description is used to describe Jesus Christ in Revelation 1 through 3, which is one of the characteristic New Testament author's way of asserting the full deity of Jesus Christ. Now, this throne with its wheels and blazing fire is very similar to the mobile throne chariot of God mentioned in Ezekiel chapters 1 and 10, and that seems to be the ideal here. Notice a river of fire was flowing out from it. In Ezekiel, there are coals of fire under the throne. Here, there's a river of fire, which speaks of not only purity or the presence of God or judgment or whatever. Now, in verse 10, there's been a lot of questions about, are these thousands and thousands angels or saints? Well, because of Deuteronomy 33:2 and because of verse 16, they may be angels. But others point to verse 18, 22, and 27 to say they're saints. Now, there's a real flux here between the king and the kingdom. It's very fluid between like Nebuchadnezzar and the Neo-Babylonian Empire. So I think the saints and the Messiah are going to be very fluid through here, and I'm not sure how we can always make a distinction. Notice where it says, the court sat, there's the idea, it was a court scene, and the books were open. Now, from Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, we know there are two sets of books. There are the books of the remembrances or the deeds of men, and there's the book of life. The saints are recorded in the book of life, but the book of deeds records both the positive and negative aspects of man's life. Once a man's name is put in the book of life, the negative aspects of the deeds are removed. Let me give you a series of scriptures here. For the book of life, see Exodus 32:32, Psalm 69:28, and Luke 10:20. For the book of deeds, notice Psalms 56:8, Psalms 139:16, Isaiah 65:6, and Malachi 3:16. I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. This little horn, or type of the Antichrist, we learn from later in the chapter, was blaspheming God, was saying braggadocious things about himself and negative things about God. And I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Now this, of course, seems to fit the total overthrow of the earthly nations against God. Why all the nations aren't mentioned here? Why just Rome and not all the succumbing nations? Well, I really think you must remember that the Old Testament only saw the first coming of Christ, and it did not see the second coming. Only from New Testament revelation do we know that Jesus is going to come twice. First incarnate as Savior, second He's going to come back as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. The Old Testament did not see that, and so it has a shortened sense of history, and that's what I think we have here. Notice where it mentions then, as for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed time. Now this seems to mean that though their power was broken, they continued to keep on as a nation, like Iran, Iraq, Greece. They're still in existence, but they don't have the world power they once had. Now, in verse 13, one of the most significant verses in all the Bible, describes the fifth kingdom, or the eternal kingdom, that God is going to set up against these four earthly representative human kingdoms. And I kept looking in night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. Now, I want to tell you, it's not the Son of Man, it's a Son of Man. I don't think it should be capitalized. It's not a title here. It's a way of speaking of human being. Now, the fact that he rode on the clouds of heaven has the inference of deity. Clouds were the transportation of deity. You might want to see Psalms 104:3. God rode on the storm clouds. And so the fact that one, like a human being, rode on the storm clouds is a term that combines deity and humanity. This term, Son of Man, is used in Ezekiel and the Psalms simply for human being. It's an Aramaic phrase for human being. But Jesus chose this as a self-designation for himself, which because it was not used in rabbinical Judaism, and it does seem to imply here in Daniel 7:13, deity and humanity, which is the essence of the Messiah. Now, let me give you a few verses about the clouds of heaven in the New Testament as a very significant thing about deity. Now, we'll see Mark 13:26, Matthew 24:30. Matthew 26:64. You might want to look in 1 Thessalonians 4:13 through 18, Revelation 1:7, Revelation 14:14, the clouds of heaven. When Jesus left the Mount of Olives, a cloud took him out of sight. He's going to come back the same way, which is the 1 Thessalonians 4 passage. Notice where it says here, the word Son of Man, but the word man is the word Enosh, not the normal word for man, Adam. Son of Man in Psalms 8, Psalms 110, and Ezekiel is Ben Adam. This is Ben Enosh. And the word, the root of the word means incurable. It may be the idea of Jesus taking on our nature and dying on our behalf. It's a different word there. The Ancient of Days is, of course, God the Father. Notice where it says, a kingdom was given to him, a glory and dominion over all peoples, nations, and men of every language, that they might serve him, universality of the kingdom. And notice that it's going to be an everlasting dominion. This cannot be the millennial kingdom because it lasts forever. This is not referring to the 1,000 years. There may be some element of that in 9, 10, 11, and 12, but not here. It's an eternal kingdom because we're looking at the whole scope of history in a nutshell, as we'll see in verses 17 and 18, which is the angel synopsis of the interpretation. Notice where it says, as for me, Daniel, my spirits were distressed within me. 15 through 28 is going to try to describe the vision he had. And he looks around and finds apparently an angel in verse 16 and says, what does this mean? Explain this to me. Notice how brief the interpretation is of the angel. And we shouldn't add a whole lot more in here that the angel says this is the essence of this vision. Number one, the four in number are four kings who arise upon the earth. Okay, four kingdoms. Number eight, but the saints of the highest will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages. Notice here, Larkin says this does not refer to the believers of the church. It refers to the Jews. Now notice how if you spit Israel in the church and make that a presupposition all the way through here, you're going to have some wild interpretation. I agree that splitting Israel and the church solves some problems of interpretation, but it makes others. I believe we have here in a wide, big stroke, God settling history, consummating history, and putting His people, Old Testament, New, in fellowship with Him back on the earth. Now, Daniel is a little uptight. He says, this little horn, this braggadocious last fourth kingdom, really was curious to him. And so he asked the angel to give him some special inferences and information about this last kingdom. And so 19 and following talk about this last king. Notice it says, waging war against the saints. Now we have some more information. During this last kingdom, this fourth, typified by Rome, there's going to be persecution of the people of God. That's something new we learn. But notice it says in verse 22 that judgment was passed in favor of the saints. God's going to overcome this fourth earthly kingdom, and the saints are going to be put back in the place of preeminence and joy. Notice it says in verse 23, the fourth beast is going to try to devour the whole earth, tread it down. He's going to have control over the whole earth, but God's not going to let it happen for a long time. Notice in verse 25, he's going to speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time and a half time. Now notice this seems to be both political and religious. Obviously in the context of Daniel, it's connected with the Jewish law. Some have said it relates pretty well to Antiochus Epiphanes IV. That's true, but that's going to be covered in chapter 8. This seems to relate something to the Antichrist at the end time. You might want to see 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 for maybe a fuller description as well as the Revelation. Now what these laws and alterations of times are, we are not sure, and it's not wise to be dogmatic in a chapter like this. Now the time frame, a time and a half time. Now in my New American Standard it says year, but that is an assumption that's not said in the text. The reason I think it's probably a good assumption is for the following reasons. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 14, evenings and mornings are mentioned, and when you figure out their number, it comes to 1,150 days. In Revelation chapter 11, verse 2, and Revelation 13, 5, it says 42 months, which comes to 1,260 days. In Daniel chapter 12, verse 11, it mentions 1,290 days, and in Daniel chapter 12, verse 12, it mentions 1,300 135 days. Now, all of those are pretty close to the same time frame. Not exactly, but they're not on a Seiko crystal watches either. It's the basic time frame that we're talking about. That's why I think probably a year and a year and a half is probably good. Now, in Daniel 12:7 and Revelation 12:14, this exact metaphor of a time and a half time is used. There's been much discussion to try to figure this out, but so far no one has been able to answer all the scriptural questions and all the questions of history to work this out. Now, verse 26. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, brought to an end, and destroyed forever. The major thrust of Daniel chapter 7 to the Jewish people who are still in exile is, God's going to restore you. These powerful earthly nations are not always going to be your destiny. There is coming a time when the sovereign God is going to act in history, and he's going to set up an eternal kingdom. To the Jews, this was the messianic age. You see, the Jews only saw two ages, the current evil age and the age of the Messiah. It is my personal opinion that the overlapping of these two Jewish ages is what's known in the New Testament as the latter days or the end time. From Bethlehem to the second coming is the latter days. We've been in it for 1900 plus years. How long it will last, we do not know. Then the sovereignty and dominion and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. Now, some have seen a contradiction here between the kingdom being given to the Son of Man in verse 13 and the kingdom being given to the saints in verse 27. Well, this goes back to what I previously said about the fluidity here between the king and the kingdom motif. It can be called the first kingdom, and Nebuchadnezzar can be the symbol, yet it stands for Neo-Babylon. The Messiah is given the kingdom, but the saints benefit it. And that seems to be the thrust here of verse 27. Now, notice where it says, the saints of the highest, his kingdom will be everlasting. If you're a dispensationalist, you make this simply a Jewish kingdom. One of my real problems with dispensational premillennialism is because it not only presuppositionally divides Israel and the church, but it also makes Revelation a very Jewish book and says that all prophecies have to be literally fulfilled to the nation of Israel. I do believe the church does fulfill some of the ancient prophecies in herself. And so to leave the New Testament age out, to make it a parenthesis in history and call it a church age, and to stop Daniel's timetable at week 69 when the church begins and not begin it until the church is raptured, in my opinion, is heavy-handed presuppositions on the text. I agree it does answer some questions in New Testament interpretation, but in my opinion, it raises many more. We must remember that it is as wrong to add to the text as it is to not say all the text says. So I want to be real careful not to put my opinion in or to leave anything out. And I think all four human systems of eschatology do that. In my opinion, the Bible does not have a systematic eschatology. It has true signs of the end time, but when men try to work the system out, they really get in problems. And I think dispensational pre, as well as all the others, have those problems. Now, notice the word, and all dominion will serve and obey him. Now, this him is not the Messiah, but it's got to be God. For this Aramaic word is always used of deity, and Jesus is not fully depicted as deity in this chapter, though the riding on the clouds of heaven is a strong inference. An equally strong emphasis is his humanity. So I think serving him must relate to the Ancient of Days, not to the Son of Man here. At this point, the revelation ended. Now, therefore, chapter 7 is a literary unit in itself. And I think because it's still in Aramaic, it consummates chapters 2, which really is a history of the Gentile nations. Now, chapter 8 is going to deal with a part of this history that's depicted in chapter 2, parallel in chapter 7. We're going to deal more in detail with the third and fourth kingdoms in chapter 8. But chapter 7 is a literary unit. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarmed me, and my face grew pale, and I kept the matter to myself. I want you to know prophecy cost this man some physical health. It's kind of like John on the Isle of Patmos. He was weary physically. He was dumbstruck over what he saw. Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, his vision of heaven, it was so awesome he couldn't even talk about it. There is a real strain here when finite man is able to view the infinite plan of God. And so Daniel had some physical repercussions from this. Now, I want to say a couple of things to you. Don't read just one book and agree with the author and say, well, I got it all worked out. Read the Bible and make sure whoever you read or listen to takes seriously the text, and not just the text of Daniel 7, but the rest of Daniel, the book of Zechariah, Matthew 24, Mark 13, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, and the book of the Revelation all seem to add some color and detail to this mosaic. And yet, we must be careful not to force our preconceived eschatological views onto the text. The text first must be allowed to speak, and once we have looked at it in context, then we can try to put the systematic whole together. So be careful of dogmatic systems. When someone tells you this is the only way it can possibly be, a little red light ought to start going off. When you take Scripture seriously, and the major thrust of this chapter is God is in control of history. He's a supernatural God that knows the end from the beginning. He is going to overcome all human and satanic opposition, and His people are going to be in eternal realm with Him. Hallelujah. Praise be unto God. What a supernatural encouragement the book of Daniel was to the people in exile and to the people in every successive generation who've trusted in God as their Savior. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.